Welcome back to the deep dive. Today, we're jumping into something really fundamental, data handling.
Yeah, it sounds maybe a bit dry, but honestly, it's the key skill, right? Turning just raw numbers into actual insights you can use.
Exactly. So our mission today, for you listening, is to get you comfortable with managing data, organizing it, and showing it in ways that tell a story. We're moving beyond just looking at spreadsheets.
We want you to feel equipped. We'll cover organizing that raw information, figuring out what's typical, using things like mean, median, and mode.
Right, and then making it visual, we'll look at bar graphs, histograms, pie charts, all the classics.
And finally, a little bit about chance. Probability. How likely is something to happen based on the data?
So by the end of this, you should be able to, you know, understand your data better, organize it logically, pick the right graph, calculate those key central measures.
And critically, interpret probability and start drawing some real conclusions from data sets. It's about building that analytical muscle.
Okay, let's start at square one. Let's unpack the basics. If you're faced with just a list of numbers, what are we even calling those?
Right. So the whole collection, maybe numerical facts about something specific, that's your data.
Like student test scores for a class.
Exactly. And each individual score on that list, that's an observation.
Got it. So the whole messy list you get first, maybe just jotted down as they come in, that's the raw data.
Precisely. The initial collection. Unsorted, unorganized, just raw.
And with that raw data, there are a couple of quick things we can figure out straight away, right? Like how often a score appears.
Yeah, that's frequency. Super simple, just counting how many times a particular observation shows up. If five students scored 85, the frequency of 85 is 5.
And the other one is the span of the data.
A range. Also straightforward. You just find the highest value and the lowest value in your data set and subtract.
So if the scores went from, say, 11 up to 19, the range is 19 minus 11, which is 8.
Exactly. Gives you a quick sense of the spread.
Okay, that works for smaller sets. But what happens when you've got like thousands of observations? A list of 1,000 scores is just noise.
Absolutely. You can't see anything useful. That's where we need to condense it. We create what's called a grouped frequency distribution.
Grouped, meaning we put observations into buckets.
Basically, yes. We create classes or class intervals. Mm-hmm. Instead of looking at every single score, we might group them, say, 0 to 10, 10 to 20, 20 to 30, and so on.
Okay. Now, there are some important rules here, aren't there, with those intervals, like 10 to 20?
Yes. Critical details. In that interval, 10 is the lower limit and 20 is the upper limit.
And the key thing is deciding where a score like 20 actually goes, right? Does it belong in 10-20 or 20-30?
Great question. The standard convention is that the lower limit is included in the class, but the upper limit is excluded.
So in the 10-20 class, a score of 10 is counted, but a score of 20 is not. It goes into the next class, 20-30.
Exactly right. It prevents double counting and keeps the groups distinct.
Okay, that makes sense. And the width of that class, like 20 minus 10, that's the size.
Yep, that's the class interval or class size. In this case, it's 10.
And one more term, you mentioned the class mark.
Right, that's just the midpoint of the class. For 10-20, you add the lower and upper limits, 10 plus 20 equals 30, and divide by 2.
So 15.
Exactly. The class mark is 15, and that number, 15, kind of becomes the representative score for everyone who fell into that 10 to 20 bin. It's useful for later calculations.
Okay, so we've organized the chaos into groups. Now, how do we actually see the patterns? Looking at a frequency table is better, but still not instant.
Yeah, that's where visualization comes in. Mm. Graphs and charts make it much easier to spot trends, compare values, just grasp the information quickly.
But there are different types. How do you know which one to use? Like, when would you pick a bar graph over, say, a pie chart?
Good question. It depends on what you want to show. Bar graphs are generally fantastic for comparing distinct categories or values.
And pie charts.
Pie charts are all about proportions, showing how a whole thing is divided up into parts, like percentages of a budget.
Okay, let's dive into the bar graph first then. We've all seen them.
Right. They use rectangular bars. Key things. The width of the bars should be uniform, and importantly, there's equal spacing between them.
Why the spacing?
That spacing visually reinforces that the categories being compared are separate and distinct. Think about comparing crop yields, wheat, rice, other cereals.
Like in the example, wheat 22 units, rice 36, other cereals 38. They're different things, so the bars don't touch.
Precisely. The height or length of the bar shows the value. making comparison easy.
Okay, but what about the group data we just talked about? Those class intervals like 0, 10, 10, 20, they flow into each other.
Ah, exactly. For group data, we use a specific type of bar graph called a histogram.
A histogram? How is it different?
The key visual difference is that in a histogram, there is no spacing between the bars. They're right up against each other.
And why no space there?
Because it represents the continuous nature of the data along that horizontal axis, the x-axis. Mm-hmm. The classes, like 10-20 flowing into 20-30, represent a continuous range of values.
So the bars touching shows that continuity. You mark the class boundaries, like 0, 10, 20, 30, on the x-axis.
And the frequency, how many observations fall into each class, on the vertical y-axis.
Right, and sometimes you see that little jagged line near the start of the x-axis.
Oh, yes, the kink. That's important.
Yeah.
If your scale on the x-axis doesn't start at zero, maybe your first class interval is 50-60, you use that kink.
To show there's a break in the scale.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It signals to the viewer that the axis isn't starting from zero, so the initial part isn't proportional. Keeps things honest visually.
Got it. Okay, third type, pie charts. Or circle graphs.
Yep, perfect for showing parts of a whole, how a total amount is broken down.
Like flavor preferences, 50% like chocolate, 25% vanilla, etc.
Exactly. The whole circle represents 100%. And each slice represents a part of that whole.
And the size of the slice matters. How's that determined?
It's all about the central angle of each sector. The calculation is key. You take the value of the specific part.
Like the number of people who prefer chocolate?
Divided by the total sum of all the values.
Yep.
So the total number of people surveyed, and then multiply that fraction by 360 degrees.
Because there are 360 degrees in a full circle. So if chocolate is 50%.
50% is 0.5. Multiply by 360, you get 180 degrees. So the chocolate slice takes up exactly half the circle.
Makes sense. And you can work backwards too, right? If you see a pie chart.
Absolutely. Let's say you have a family's monthly income chart. Total income is, say, $9,005. And the slice labeled food has a central angle of maybe 120 degrees.
Okay.
You can figure out the amount spent on food. You do 120 degrees, 360 degrees, times the total income, $9,000.
So that's one-third of 9,000, which is 3,000 spent on food.
Exactly. It lets you read the proportion visually and then calculate the actual value if you know the total.
Right. So we've organized data, found its center, visualized it. Now let's shift gears a bit to talk about, well, chance, uncertainty.
Right. We use phrases like most probably or there's a good chance all the time in everyday life. Probability is just a mathematical way to measure that uncertainty.
Okay. Are there specific terms we need here too?
Yeah, a few key ones help clarify things. An experiment is just any situation involving chance that leads to some result, like drawing a card from a deck.
And what makes it random?
A random experiment is one where you can't predict the exact outcome beforehand. Tossing a fair coin, you know, it'll be heads or tails, but not which one before you toss it.
So the result of one coin toss, say heads, that's an outcome.
Yep. Heads is one outcome, tails is the other.
And an event, is that different?
An event can be one or more outcomes. For example, if you roll a standard six-sided die, the event getting an even number includes three outcomes, 2, 4, and 6.
I see. And if the coin or die is fair,
then we assume the outcomes are equally likely. Heads has the same chance of occurring as tails. Each number on the die has the same 16th chance.
Okay. Now, probability itself, it's always a number, right? What's the scale?
It's always a number between 0 and 1 inclusive.
Zero means?
Zero means it's absolutely impossible. It cannot happen. Probability is 0.
And 1.
1 means it's absolutely certain it will happen. Probability is 1.
So most things in life fall somewhere between 0 and 1, a fraction or a decimal.
Exactly. It measures the likelihood. And the way we often calculate this, especially based on observations, is using empirical probability.
Empirical, meaning based on what actually happened in an experiment?
Precisely. The formula is pretty intuitive. The probability of an event equals the number of outcomes that count as that event happening.
Okay.
Divided by the total number of outcomes possible in the experiment.
Mm.
Or, if you're doing trials, the number of times the event occurred divided by the total number of trials.
Right, like your coin toss example. If you tossed it 40 times and you got heads 20 times, the number of outcomes making the event heads is 20.
Yep.
The total number of trials or outcomes of the experiment was 40.
Right.
So the probability of getting a head, based on this experiment, is 20 divided by 40.
Which simplifies to 0.5 or 50%. It gives you a concrete number for the champs based on what you observed. Hashtag tag outro.
Wow. Okay. That brings us through the whole journey, really, from raw, messy data.
Yeah. Taming it with organization.
Figuring out the typical value with mean median mode.
Giving it a voice with bar graphs, histograms, pie charts.
And finally, getting a handle on uncertainty with probability. That's quite a toolkit.
It really is. And the value for you listening is building that analytical confidence. You don't have to be intimidated by numbers anymore.
You can define them, organize them, pick the right tools to analyze and present them.
Exactly. These skills, numeracy, problem solving, critical thinking, they apply everywhere. Science, business, economics, even just making sense of news articles.
Okay, so for a final thought, something for you to take away and think about, we talked about grouping data into class intervals for histograms.
Yeah, the choice of interval size.
Right. Think about how choosing that interval size, say, grouping ages in 5-year bins versus 10-year bins, fundamentally changes the shape of the histogram you end up with.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, a different interval size can reveal or hide different patterns.
So the question is, how much does that initial seemingly simple choice influence the story the data appears to tell? And what responsibility does that place on the person creating the visual?
That's a great point to ponder, how the way you group data shapes the narrative. It highlights the critical thinking needed before you even draw the chart.
Something to keep in mind next time you see grouped data presented. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into data handling.
My pleasure.
Until next time, keep analyzing.